Yeah, so in this talk, I'll be returning once again to fractional quantum Hall states, but take a look at them from a somewhat different perspective than usual, which is their entanglement properties. And we'll try to see what we can learn from that perspective. I'm reporting on work done with Masoud Haq, who's now in Dresden, at the Max Planck Institute, and my student Sasha Zalzulia in Amsterdam. There's one paper out, and we're working on a project. As you'll see, we don't have the full story yet, but we are in the middle of it. This is the plan of what I want to do. I'll try to be short. I mean, make sure I don't go too much over time and jeopardize the next event. So I'll bring up entanglement, you know, just as a very short introduction, and then slowly move towards these fractional quantum Hall states and discuss a number of entanglement notions that we think make sense to consider. Okay, so first a few words about entanglement. This is like a one-slide crash course, I guess. In 1935, you know, so rather late in the history of quantum mechanics, this concept was brought up by Schrödinger. So he introduces Verschränkung. You know, it sounds much better in German than it does in English. And you know, Dutch is the worst in my language. It's a terrible word, which I won't even say aloud here. A few people in the audience know. Okay, so Schrödinger, sort of once again, some 10 years after, you know, the main formula of quantum mechanics was established, he sort of identified this issue as of entanglement as a key issue in the business. And you know, in the text where he first brings this up, he ends saying that, you know, I would not call that one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. By the interaction, the two representatives, so he has a story about two quantum systems that meet and get entangled. So he says, you know, they have become entangled. And it's just the same year of the EPR paradox of the Schrödinger cat. All that happened rather late and, you know, sort of put the strangeness of quantum mechanics in the most pronounced way, I guess. So now my summary skips about 50 years or so, where lots of things happened that I won't mention. But then there's two things that I do want to mention. The first is that since the 1980s or so, entanglement was recognized as a key resource for quantum communication, quantum computation, and all that. And of course, you know all these things, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But they sort of started developing not too long ago. And then even much more recent, there was another aspect of entanglement, especially in the context of condensed matter physics. You know, people have started considering various entanglement measures as in efforts to characterize the nature of quantum many-body states. So, you know, you can ask this question, having a many-body state of matter, you know, in what way are the participating particles, the atoms, the electrons, are they entangled? And if you study that, what does it tell you? So it's a sort of a new take on you know, correlated matter, and from this point of view of entanglement. And you see, obviously, both these aspects of entanglement are relevant in a workshop like this, where we consider topological quantum computation, because in particular this one here, there will be a connection with topological order in quantum states of matter, which we can try to sort of track or identify using these entanglement measures. Okay, so let me sort of start slowly then. You know, there is, it's not a completely well posed question if you say, now here's a state of matter with so many atoms, so how entangled are they? Or what is the entanglement of this state? So you have to be sort of precise of what you mean by that and what your notion is going to be. So there's quite a few measures around. I'll focus entirely on what I call bipartite entanglement entropies, which I guess is the main line of these things. And in a very general setting, you know, it's defined like this. So there is this quantum system, and what you do is you partition it in two pieces. Okay, so there's a block A and a block B. And these could be various. They could be particles, they could be spatial regions, or whatever you want, and you'll see various things coming. You then take your density matrix rho and trace out the B part, okay? Keeping the degrees of freedom pertaining to your A part, your A block, and then you take the phenomenon entropy of that. So the trace of rho log rho. And if you do, you know, if you only have two pieces, you know, this is symmetric between A and B in the end. So this is a very general thing. You have to make a decision on which part you call A, which you call B, and then you just compute the number if you have full access to the wave function, say, or the quantum state. So here's an example, just to make sure you're with me. You know, if you have two spin and halves, say, if they're in the product state like this, first one up, second one down, they're not entangled. You know, if you would trace out, let's say, the second particle, you would be in a pure state for the first, and that would be just entropy zero. But if you put them in a Bell state like this here, with either sign, you would have the maximally possible value for this entropy, which is log 2 in this case. Okay, so this is sort of the baby example that we want to look at, just with many more particles. Now, one thing then is what's called the area law, or the boundary law for bipartite entanglement entropy. So this is the case where the A and the B blocks are really spatial regions, okay, of the system in some number of dimensions. So you identify a piece of space, which you call A, the rest you call B, and then on sort of general grounds, you expect that this entanglement entropy, as A or as B, will be proportional to the area that separates the block A and the block B. Since in a sense, you know, the degrees of freedom close to the bounding area between the two pieces will contribute to this entropy. So in sort of first approximation, this is what you expect. Okay, so if you're in D dimensions and you have some kind of blob, which you call A, then you'll get some kind of scaling, again, to first approximation, with this entropy going like a length scale turning to A to the power D minus 1 in D dimensions. Okay? And I guess if you do free bosons, for example, this would be an exact result for that. But now the interesting thing is that the jazz is not so much in this area law, which is rather obvious, but it's in all the exceptions and the subleading terms and the corrections to that law. So again, exceptions and subleading terms, if you look beyond this leading behavior, they are kind of interesting, and if you pick them well, they can tell you sort of secrets about your many bodies. And that's something that's sort of slowly being developed, and there's a number of examples where this is a rather spectacular access to sort of the essence of this quantum state. Okay, so focusing then on this many-body entanglement, so our system will be not so much a few qubits or anything like that, but a many-body state of matter. We're going to study these bipartite entanglement entropies, and now we're sort of focusing on three aspects of the many-body physics that we can learn about using these entanglement measures. One is quantum criticality. I'll mention a few things. It won't be my topic for today. The second is topological order, and the third are sort of correlations. So before I come to my quantum hostage, let me say a few words about each of these three aspects then. First of all, the connection to criticality, which is, you know, a famous and beautiful story. One thing, if your system is 1D, so 1D spatial, if it's critical, then there is, the boundary law would say, you know, the entropy goes like L to the zero, because, you know, D minus 1 would be zero, but in that case there is a subleading important term if the system is critical, which would be like a log of the length of your A block with a universal coefficient in front, which is central charge over 3. So if there's conformal field theory with a central charge describing this critical phase, then this entropy comes out universally in this manner with C, the central charge in that theory. Okay, and there's a number of groups who made this important observation. And the system is 2D, spatially 2D, and critical, there's a similar result. Now the leading term will be linear in the length scale, the boundary, or the area law once again, but there can be subleading terms that again sort of tell you about criticality in your system, and you know, I won't say anything beyond this because Eduardo Fredkin's here, but he'll tell us all about it tomorrow, I think. Okay, second aspect then, that's this connection to topological order, which is obviously important for us here. So I'm here more or less summarizing on one sheet a result, a theorem, if you wish, put forward by two groups, Kitaev and Peskill, and Levin and Gwen, and they made the following observation. If you're 2D spatially, and you're in the topological phase, in that case, there is again this area law for the entropy. So you have an A an A block, which is, let's say, some disk around your gym is radius LA, and the rest of the system is the B block, there will be aerial law alpha times L sub A for the entropy, but then the prediction is that there will be a universal subleading term, which is called minus gamma, before there's the 1 over L terms. And this gamma has been identified as containing information on the topological order in this state in the following manner. It's predicted to be the log of quality called D, the total quantum dimension, which again in its turn is gotten by a sum of, well, this thing here is square root of the sum over sectors of quantum dimensions squared per sector. So maybe I should have made a second slide with just a few explanations. So you should think topological quantum field theory where there are these different sectors of particles, for example. If you think one of your fractional quantum Hall states of filling 1 over m as they will be coming, there will be these m different sectors, let's say Brownian from the torus. So what you do is per sector you determine this quantum dimension, which will be 1 if it's an abelian sector and will be more if it's a non-abelian sector. And you make this combination, add it all, and obtain this number d. And the prediction again is kind of miraculously that this combination, but this particular information about topological order, shows up in this entropy law. Okay, and obviously one challenge that I'll address in this talk here is to see if this sort of abstract general result can be recognized in actual quantum Hall wave functions as we have them, and that will follow. But before I do that, the third notion, so there was this quantum criticality as one aspect, topological order as the second, and the third is just plain correlations. And we've been trying to see what we can do there. And in this case, acting a bit differently. So in this case, we partition our system not so much in one spatial region and the rest, but we partition according to particle content. So we put a bunch of particles, let's say 1, 2, something, in the first set, the A set, or the A block, and the rest in the B block. So we do particle partitioning, and then we follow the standard procedure and we extract this entropy. And so what we claim is that this entropy then contains information about, if you wish, n-body correlations in the state, in a very general sense. And one explicit result, which I'll be showing a bit later in this talk, which has some generality to it, which is maybe beyond this example of quantum Hall states, is that the entropy, in this case, this S sub A, if you put n A particles, it has a, if you wish, a sort of obvious, rather trivial piece, which is just, well, a free fermion factor, combinatorial factor that you would write if you had free fermions with no interactions. So the log of some combinatorial factor of putting your fermions in the number of orbitals that's available. That factor you expect, that term. But then there are subleading corrections, and they sort of know about it or correlations. So in this case, there will be a 1 over n leading correction to this leading result. And it knows about the two-point nature of the directions, as n times n minus 1. It also knows about the strength of these things. For example, in an integer quantum Hall state n equals 1, this will be absent. You will just this piece. But in the fractional case, this will be present with a certain strength depending on n.
What's NA here?
NA would be the number of particles you put in the A block.
Okay,
so if you put 1, actually there's no correction. This is specific for quantum Hall, as an example. If you put 2, you see a two-body correlation effect sort of manifest if you want to know this entropy happen in the dependence on n. So, but I'll come back to this with a bit of derivation later. Okay, so these were then these three aspects: criticality, topological order, and correlations. And now I'll finally zoom in on my quantum states of preference, which are these quantum Hall states. And so the question is, which is also actually how this project started, at some point over coffee we had this discussion, how entangled are quantum Hall states. Well, 2 years later, this is the report of what we found. So here's a quantum Hall state, there's a picture, there's a formula, whatever you like best. Let's address these things. And let's take two kind of partitionings to do this bipartite entanglement entropy. One is spatial partitioning, and the other is partitioning according to particle groups, A group and B group. Okay, so now the setting for doing this, we put our things on the sphere for rather obvious reasons. You have to decide on the geometry to study these Laughlin wave functions or quantum Hall wave functions. These will be the Laughlin ones. And the sphere, is kind of preferred because it gets rid of boundaries that would be troubling all kinds of considerations. and it makes a nice five-dimensional hilbert space where you can look at things. So this is a standard setup that's usually used for these kind of studies. So we have n fermions, our electrons, spin polarized. They sit on this sphere. If you wish, there's a monopole at the origin that makes the organic flux needed for the quantum Hall state. They have density 1 over m, where m is this odd integer. Okay, so the amount of flux needed to make the state is this much flux quanta, so m times n minus 1, if total m is the particle number. And then there's this picture of lambda orbitals. So the one-body problem, so to say, in this geometry with magnetic field and everything, would give you a lambda-level situation where there are these different orbitals, and they're sort of nicely structured. They're spatially localized along latitude lines, so there's an orbital at the North Pole, the second a bit further south, and then they are nicely concentric circles. That's where the non-orbitals are localized. And there's also a good angular SO3 algebra, so to say. So there's angular momentum that's a good quantum number for this system, and that you can use to classify things and to recognize symmetries and things like that. So to be precise, the number of orbitals then is derived from 0 to n5, so it's one more than this number here. So it's roughly, if let's say m is 3, the number of orbitals is 3 times the number of particles, because you're at 1/3 filling. But these are the orbitals, and if you look at where they sit, if you imagine having the sphere large, so that there's lots of orbitals close to the North Pole, the location of number L of this set of orbitals would be roughly the square root of L away from the North Pole. Okay, and that's important, because we'll be talking about dependencies of entropies on spatial scales. So this square root of L will come back later. Okay, so this is on the sphere then, where everything's five-dimensional and rather clean. But if you wish to consider the usual disk geometry or planar geometry, you can simply go back there by projecting in a circle projection back to a plane. And that will bring you back to the standard form of the Laughlin wave function on a complex plane. Okay, so this is the setting. The wave function is of course known, so it's in a sense we can just start deciding on our A and our B subsets and just compute these entropies like that. Okay, so then the first choice for the A and the B parts will be orbital partitioning. So the choice, which is very natural, if you know you're on this sphere where these lambda orbitals are the natural places for the electrons to go, it's natural to make, say, an A block, which is the first L orbitals from the top. So that's the North Pole and the next so many stopping at LA minus 1. And then the B block is everybody else. So A is this little cap, and B is all the rest of the sphere. Okay? Okay, and there you go. Now, the point is that if we act it this way, there will be a boundary between the A and the B, which is exactly sort of the separation between the L and the L plus first lambda orbital. So, and if you look at where that sits, it sits at roughly square root of LA as a radius. Okay. And if we then simply be bold and then jump to this, to applying this general result about topological order and entropy, we would expect something like this here. So we would expect that this entropy, when we cut off at LA, would be this universal form. So it could be alpha times length, where length is now the square root of L, because there was this location at square root of LA. And then there would be an intercept minus gamma, which, if everything goes well, should correspond to the one proposed in the general formulation. So this is the expectation, and so what we set out doing was trying to see if we could actually recognize this from our finite size Laughlin wave functions. Okay, well, before I come to results and data, let me bring up an issue which is something that we are not so sure about if it does or does not complicate the picture. You see, this is a plot of the radial profiles, the density profiles of these lambda orbitals, so the psi squared. So this is, let's say, I guess I drew a few, so this is the second, this is the third, and then I skipped a few, and then I drew, let's say, the L minus first and the Lth orbital. Okay, and the point is they're rather fat. They get closer and closer, but they're highly overlapping, and they're not sort of delta function profiles at all. So now the proposal for orbital partitioning is the following. So, you know, there's the red stuff, which is block A, that's everybody up to and including, let's say, L minus 1. And then the B block is the blue stuff, that's everybody beyond. And so the cut, if you wish, between the A block and the B block would be like here. And that's sharply located in the square root of L. So this point you can compute in this square root of L, so that's all right. But then, you know, it's certainly true that this is a rather soft division between the A and the B block. Because we keep, let's say, the red one here, which goes way over the separating line, and we reject the blue one, the first blue one, which also extends well into the block A spatial region. Okay, and if you look at scales, if L goes large, which of course it has to be for the asymptotic behavior, well, these orbitals get very close, because the separation between two consecutive separation lines is only like one over root L, so they sort of go closer and closer. But on the other hand, the width that they have is like unity. They don't get sharper and sharper, but they keep this unit width. So this effect does not go away if L goes large. They keep overlapping, and they keep having this finite width. And again, we're not completely sure if because of this, we can sort of blindly say, well, orbital partitioning equals spatial partitioning. Because in one sense it is, because, you know, there's clearly a special point square root of L which separates in and out. But on the other hand, it's not, because it's a very soft thing, and both regions sort of spill over into the forbidden one. And to be honest, we don't know about this. I'd like to hear comments if you should say, well, this is something that should stop you from comparing the two sides, or maybe it's not that harmful. We're not so sure. But I can show you what we obtained by, you know, sticking to this orbital partition. So here are the rough data, you know, which is just what you get if you do the thing on a computer. So let me give you what this plot is. So we pick an m, so the Laughan exponent, say n equals 3. We pick particle numbers, say n equals 9. So that's, in this case, there would be, what's that, 27 orbitals or so on the sphere that participated in the state with 9 particles, which are roughly 1/3 filled. And then we simply took this LA, you know, the boundary between the A and the B blocks, and put it to all possible places. And that makes, you know, all these points here, L equals 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., all the way till the highest value, 28 or so. Now clearly there's a symmetry. I told you A and B are symmetric in construction, so clearly there's a reflection symmetry between L and 28 minus L or something like that. So that was expected. But it is, of course, a finite size effect. So it's something that is, in a sense, troubling our analysis, but it comes out as it should do that. And you see more points here. This is another m equals 3 with fewer particles. This is an m equals 5 data set. Okay, so this is what you get if you just do it. And this is sort of without any approximation. This is precise and accurate. Now, this needs to be processed then to extract, you know, let's say in the end, this gamma that we're after. And we need a few steps to do that. And the first is that, you know, we're on a finite sphere, but we want to be on the plane. We want to have a big, wide quantum Hall state where the LA sits, you know, well away from this boundary of the droplet, so to say. So we need n to be very large. So what we need to do is to, if you wish, extrapolate for a given L, so suppose we fix L at, let's say, the 10th orbital, we would like to have the value of the entropy for n going to infinity, for an infinite quantum Hall system with L fixed at, let's say, 10 or so. And so, well, that would mean, you know, so in the previous thing that we fix L and we sort of go over consecutive n's and see the thing saturate and pick up that value as a limiting value. And you see, in principle, this works fine. If you do, for example, L equals 3, I guess that's the red ones, you know, they grow a bit when n is getting bigger, and then they saturate nicely. And there's a very clear limit that you can extract by just looking at, you know, this value here, that would be it. And this would be it for L equals 1. But then you see, you know, we have to stop somewhere. So our numerics at this, what I report here, stopped at, I guess, 10 particles for the Laughan 1/3 state on the sphere, you know, which is decent. It's not the best you can do. I guess with more effort, you could maybe go to 14 or 15 or so, and that's the field is the limit. So there is a bit of room to improve on this, but what I show here is for 10 particles, and you see there's trouble. For example, if this L is 10, then, you know, there's no saturation, and we have to extrapolate sort of, you know, with a bit of hindsight to get a value for a data point that equals 10. Okay, so we did what we could and produced these extrapolated values, and that gave then these data points. So now you see here these L's again, a ready-made L root. And these are these extrapolated values, you know, n to infinity of the S of L sub A. Okay, so the first few points are almost certain because, you know, they're well-saturated points. But the higher we go, you know, there are some uncertainties, and we put some error bars here to reflect that. So these are the uncertainties in the extrapolation for n goes to infinity. Okay? And these are the points we could get. So I think we started at equals 12 or so, where, you know, this, our data set ended. And well, so this is, you know, this is the stuff, and you already see a blue dotted line through this. So what we did, you know, we fitted this set of data points, so the extrapolated data points, to the expected behavior, and you know, it fits quite well, if you wish, and we could extract a gamma value. So there's a minus negative intercept over here, and you know, the only value we got without looking what we were expecting is minus, well, the 0.6, minus 0.6, plus or minus 0.1 or so. And again, so this plus or minus comes from, well, a few things. One is that there are these error bars on the data points, and the other is that, you know, that there's no perfect line going through all these things, because we may not yet be in this asymptotic regime where there is actual linear behavior. So there's a number of uncertainties, but collecting them, we settled for this number. And now the number predicted from the topological quantum field theorem would be, in this case, the log of the root of 3. So I told you that it was the log of the root of the sum of d squared. So in this case, there's 3 d is all equal to 1. So it's this number, and that's 0.55. So we think it's a decent match, but we also realize that the whole story is not complete. And we would like to, certainly like to for one thing, improve this data set, you know, and get a smaller error bar. And on the other hand, we would like to understand better if what we do is correct at all. You know, this business with the fat orbitals that overlap into the wrong region, they could give systematic corrections that are not included in this simple fit. And so these things are open, and again, the best we can do, I guess, is think about the one issue and work on the other in the sense of getting more data points from the computer. Yeah.
Suppose for your Hilbert space you hadn't started with the Laughlin level, had forgotten that the all these states were within Laughlin level, and just tried to study the entropy in the broader space of you know, configurations of electrons.
So you mean forget about the Lambda level?
Well,
so
yes. Did I say Laughlin and Lambda? Yeah. I mean, you use that to get a nice finite dimensional Hilbert space,
right,
to begin the calculation in. But suppose you hadn't inputted that information and just started with the wave function and tried to partition the system along the longitude of the sphere.
You mean a really sharp spatial cut?
Well, yeah, just began with a larger Hilbert space that just was anti-symmetric wave functions and didn't assume, you know, that it was in the Lambda level.
Yeah, of course, the Lambda wave function as such is there. It is polynomial, so it only uses those orbitals.
I know it only uses those orbitals, but I don't think it follows that you get the same answer for entropy by doing partial trace of in the larger Hilbert space.
No, that would be true, I guess. So that would be, I guess you're suggesting we don't take the shortcut of doing orbital partitioning, but we actually take the honest spatial.
I'm asking if you'd expect the same answer or not.
I would expect yes, but I'm not sure about it. I can't sort of prove this.
So there is a physical issue here. You know, because you are in a magnetic field, you cannot localize a particle better than a magnetic level.
Right.
So this approach has that feature.
Yeah, we stumble into that. And
more or less by, you know, by construction. You know.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, it's true. The way you normally think of entropy is you draw a circle or something. And, but that's because you think that you want to localize a particle down to that landscape.
Yeah. Well, the trouble is we're after a subleading term. And
yes.
So sort of small corrections,
right.
Suppose we shift root LA by some fine amount, they would kill the intercept. So it's rather delicate. And well, so the hope is, you know, again, if you push this thing, the numerics to 15 particles, this would be really sharp, really a lot better. And we could probably decide, you know, with a few more decimal places if it works in this special case. And we would get more confidence for that. You see, the reason is we want to be sure, because in principle this is, well, two things. The first thing is that there would be an alternative for extracting this gamma, which is actually suggested in both papers that I cited, which would be to put two boundaries. So you could, for example, say there's an A running from the top to here, and then there's B running from here to here. And then, you know, if you take this combination as B minus S, A minus S, A and B together, you actually cancel the boundaries, and you would sort of get this gamma strip. Because there would be three gammas, and you would be left with one, and the boundaries would be subtracted by this combination, which, again, is inspired by similar proposals in the two papers. And if you could do this, you know, it is maybe it's cleaner, because it would sort of eliminate this issue of how exactly these boundaries are processed, because they're subtracted anyway, and you would make the same mistake twice and subtract it. So in principle, this seems to be the superior way to go. But the problem then is, again, finite size problem, because now, you know, you have three things. You know, you want LA to be much above zero, LB much above LA, and everybody much below M sub phi. And, you know, on a finite size like we have in the computer, we can't fit these things. And so we tried this sort of in a preliminary study, and it looks worse. It doesn't seem to get close to the expected value at all, simply because our band, so the A to B band, seems to be has too few orbitals to sort of has recognize it has two boundaries. It sort of seems to, so that we get a derivation from the expected deviation, which seems to reflect that this thing is simply too narrow. And you know, so the best we can do is 10 particles. We have, let's say, 30 orbitals. We could do 10 here, 10 here, 10 here. But again, that doesn't seem to be good enough to get the number sharp. But we're working on that, and we hope to be able to do this and to compare the two extractions and see if they match. Okay, now suppose everything works. There is an interest, which is the following. So getting the number right for Loughton is like an exercise, you know, like a check if everything is properly done. But if this procedure does work, it has the potential of maybe learning us new things about other wave functions. So suppose there's a wave function which is obtained from, you know, an honest-to-God diagonalization of a Hamiltonian that's realistic. What we usually do then, if we suspect, you know, there's a Pauling Hall type behavior, we take overlaps. We say, you know, it's 0.857, that's quite good, so it must be in the universality class of that Pauling Hall grading behavior, etc. Which is one way to do it, but this would be a second way. So if you would have finite size wave functions from realistic potentials, and you have enough size in those wave functions, you could simply measure this gamma in the computer. Okay. Extract it by doing this procedure, making all the plots we made, put the straight line, read of gamma. And you could that way decide if this wave function that somebody gave you is going to have topological order, yes or no. And that could be interesting. You know, like yesterday from Steve, all these searches for new states and are they yes or no in the right class and do they have yes or no topological order as we wanted, but this could maybe help. And suppose, you know, again, for the five half states, suppose there is a result from a local calculation of a state that's close to it. This you could check in this procedure if it produces the right amount of gamma, which would be the log of root 8 for these states. Okay, so we're working on that and trying to see if we can at least demonstrate in some simple case if this could work at all or not. And again, the main caveat would be that there's just not enough size in the computer to get this to work. But maybe it's a bit better than that. Okay. So that much for the topological order and this spatial partitioning. Now here's the other type of partitioning, which is a different look at the same Pauling Hall wave functions. So now we put n A of our particles in block A and the rest of them in block B. And we see what that gives. Now, if you consider, you know, so you trace out the B particles, so you're left with NA fermions. And they have, you know, at the most this number of orbitals available, the number of orbitals that you have on this sphere. So the maximal entropy they can ever produce if they sort of spread over all of our states, like a state of determinant, so to say, would be the log of this combinatorial factor. And, you know, every state for fermions on the sphere will be at the most at that entropy. And as soon as this thing is not a free fermion system, but it's interacting, it will be below that value. Okay. So this is like a naive upper bound, simply because you're talking fermions. And the issue is, I guess, in a very general sense, interacting fermions will sort of stay below this upper limit by a certain amount, and that certain amount tells you things about correlations. So in general, it's probably very difficult to compute these things. But for the quantum Hall state, the Loughton states, we could do a few things. We couldn't compute completely what SA is, but we could improve this bound by quite a bit and show that our data points are rather close to that improved bound. So let me, maybe this example helps for those of you who are a bit familiar with these things. So let's just put in some numbers. So suppose we have n equals 3, third Lofton state, n particles. So that means we have this many orbitals, and you know they organize in an angular momentum multiplet of L equals this much. Okay, so 2L plus 1 would be the number of orbitals. So the first particle, the one particle problem, is just you know one orbital of angular momentum is that many states. Now suppose we keep two fermions. So by the way, if you restrict to just one particle, you know that particle is evenly spread over all these orbitals. And you do find the maximal entropy that is allowed, simply the log of the number of orbitals. If you give two fermions, in principle, you know, you put two fermions in this many orbitals, and you can simply you know add the angular momentum of these two fermions and anti-symmetrize, and that gives you that the total angular momentum of these two particles can be well this much, all the way down in steps of 2 to 0. And that's just if they were free particles. But now they're not, because they come from tracing over a Laughlin state. And you know, in the Laughlin state, for example, suppose you put your first particle at the maximal LZ value, which would be the North Pole. And now comes your second particle. You know, it can't be right next to the first. It can be on top of it because of fermionic statistics, but it can't be next to it because you know, in the Laughlin state, that configuration is projected out. So it has to keep a bit of a distance. And what that means is that the multiplet of highest L, highest total L for two particles, is absent. It's fully absent. There's a sharp zero eigenvalue in the reduced density matrix. So you lose a number of states, which is you know, 2 times 3n-4 plus 1 from the total count that you have for two particles. So without this restriction, you would have this many states, but you do have this many minus the subtraction, which is a smaller number. Okay, and this then, you know, you can generalize this. This was two particles, and it was three, but you can do this counting in a very general fashion. And so that actually gives the following result. So in the general case, if you take into account these vanishings due to the Laughlin correlations, if you wish, which are sharp vanishings with strict zeros, so you get a strict bound, it reduces to this here. So the naive bound for just fermions reduces to this bound for fermions in the Laughlin situation. So proving this formula was actually interesting. So we relied for that on counting results due to Nick and Ed for quasi-holes in Laughlin state. So the idea is, you know, we only have two particles left there, or n sub a particles, but we have way too many orbitals for just a regular quantum Hall state of two particles, or na particles. So if you wish, there's lots of excess flux. So if you wish, there's lots of quasi-holes. And so Nick and Ed counted precisely how many ways there are to put these quasi-holes in all those orbitals. And that number we can simply pick up from the books and process it in this way here, and that produced this upper bound here, you know, which you saw on the previous slide in a special example. So in this case, if n equals 3, you subtract 2 times n minus 1, which is exactly this subtraction here. Okay. So this number is available in full generality, and it's a strict bound. So you know, talking in the Mathematics Institute, I'm happy to present a rigorous result. This is a strict upper bound to the entropy. Okay, one thing then which is interesting, although maybe not too surprising for the experts, this combinatorial factor has an interesting interpretation. It's namely the following. It's the way you can put these Na particles in N5 plus 1 orbitals, which you should do, but keeping a distance between adjacent particles that you fill, or orbitals that you fill, of exactly N units. Okay? So if you simply do that problem, so there's N5 plus 1 orbitals, you put in Na fermions, but you decide to keep them apart by m steps because of you know, the Laughlin exclusion, precisely that number comes out. So it gives a very nice intuition of what's going on here. So in a sense, this entropy sort of betrays, if you wish, or indicates, or lays bare the exclusion statistics of these particles in that many-body state. Now, so let me now show you some data. So this is an upper bound. It's not a sharp value. This is not what SA is. It's just a reduced upper bound, as I said. So let's see how it compares to the data. So here is the results from the computer again. N equals 3, N equals 5. This is number of particles in the A set. This is total. A set is 2 in this case. N equals 2. This is the particles in the total state. And so we drew this naive bound, this free fermion bound with the green line, and we drew this improved bound with the red line. And we drew the data points, so the blue dots. And you see with the naked eye that this improved bound is pretty good. It's right on top of these data points, well, it's not right on top, but it's getting very close to these data points, whereas this first bound, which was just fermions, is quite a bit off. So it seems that by including this reduction due to the Laughlin correlations, if you wish, we get really very close to the entropy that we measure in the computer. And that's quite nice. So if you expand, so if you took this formula, the one that I showed you as an exact form, you can simply, you know, inspect the difference between this one here and this one there to see the deviation. So if you wish, the room between the green and the red lines, and that's simply an expansion, which goes like 1 over n. This is the formula I showed in the introduction. So the strict result is that the boundary is smaller than this naive value minus this much here. And again, this subtraction is sort of nicely indicative of correlations in the Laughlin state. It's a two-body effect. It goes with strength n minus 1, and it's, you know, a leading 1 over n term in this entropy. Well, so if you then think a bit, I mean, this state has been studied before. Of course, you can. So this effect here, you know, I told you it comes from the vanishing of certain multiplets in this two-body density matrix. And then in turn, if you think a bit and you sort of focus on spatial correlations, that corresponds to the fact that, you know, there's reduced amplitude in two-body correlators. So if you imagine having a first particle somewhere in the Laughlin state, and you look for the amplitude of having a second nearby at distance r, there's a fat zero, which goes like r to the 2m or something. And, you know, if you trace that back, it's the same origin. It's the same vanishing of the same eigenvalue from two-body density matrix that manifests itself as a fat zero here and as a subtraction, the entropy there. So in that sense, we saw this coming, and there's not too much of a surprise since we understand this state so well. This result had to be like this.
So in that sense, it's surprising that you don't see it in here, but one in a full envelope.
Yeah, but that's the fermionic nature. So the vanishing of this thing for nu equals 1 is just this state, it's just this here. That's just fermions. But the additional suppression is due to correlations, and that's this thing here. Yeah. Okay, so well, then the general statement is that maybe, you know, for other states, a similar inspection of entropy for particle subsets could be interesting and could tell you new things about correlations, things you don't already know because you studied the state so well before. Just for example, because I knew you would be asking if we would show it, if you do this for Moore Reed, fermionic Moore Reed, let's say at filling 1 over 2m. Okay, so m equals 2 for, what do I do? 1 over m is m even, it should be 1 over m. I'm sorry. And then you see what happens, which is kind of interesting. If you again do this reduction of the entropy as compared to the free fermion value. And now for this case, it matters if you're at, you know, the actual Moore rate at 5 halves, so to say, the 1 half filled state, or at one of the other guys. Because this one is interesting. If you are at n equals 2, so the 1 half filled state, you know, there is no 1 over n term, and there is no 2 body term, so to say. So the leading term in that case is a 1 over n squared correction, which is 3 body in nature, n and minus 1 and minus 2. And we knew that. Sorry?
It's n equals 1 over n, right?
Yes, this is a typo. Sorry. 1 over n, and then it's like this. So it's the even n, which are the fermionic guys. So, but you see, in this case, it's kind of interesting that the leading correction beyond just free fermions is a three-body effect. And of course we knew that, because the Hamiltonian has been shown in this conference before, to enforce having the Moore-Reed state, you need a three-body interaction on these fermions. And you see this come back to you in the fact that these leading corrections are three-body. If you go to the other M's, you know, it's a two-body interaction on top of the three-body one, and that leads, so you get this as a first correction. And that's more like the Laughlin data itself.
So if you did the boson cases, would you get the same things just with the m? So in other words, the same formulas would apply to bosons.
Right.
And 1 over n.
You would change this then,
yeah.
If it's bosons.
Yeah, yeah.
And then for n equals 1, they would again be leading in the cubic order. And for the other m's, would be down here. Yeah, we checked that. Now, of course, what is a bit sad is that, you see, this is the result, there's this bound. You know, which is the 1 over n squared thing, and which is a rigorous result. But the actual difference between S and this log of this here will probably be 1 over n. Because, you know, beyond this thing that we can sort of completely process, which is this vanishing of some of the eigenvalues in the density matrix, there's also some scatter of the remaining eigenvalues, the non-zero ones. And that also gives a reduction of this S. So the fact that my blue dots were not right on this red line, but slightly below it, if you wish, comes from eigenvalue scatter, from the non-zero eigenvalue that scatter a bit. And they will do the same for the Moreid state. So probably there will be, if you do actual data points and you fit them, there will be a 1 over n term with a small coefficient due to this eigenvalue scatter. So you probably won't quite be able to decide that there's three body correlations leading in the state, although you may get the indication if you see this kind of behavior coming. So but again, you could do the same kind of entropy extraction for, let's say, a hierarchy state or some other state that somebody gives you, and you can try to decide on this basis about the nature of the correlations that you have in the state. So I guess that was it. So there's a double message from the story, two ways of partitioning with the corresponding bipartite entropies. The orbital partitioning seems to make contact with this theorem on topological order and maybe actually a way of getting your hands on it. And the other wave partitioning makes contact with correlations and with exclusion statistics properties in the quantum Hall wave functions. So thank you very much.